My name is Nancy McCarthy. Hello. For the past 31 years, I have worked for the Missouri Department of Corrections Board of Probation and Parole. And I'd really like to thank you for allowing me to come talk about AA and corrections. But before I start, I do want to tell you a story. A couple years ago, one of my friends in the fellowship called and said it was the fifth Friday approaching. And so it was chair's choice in terms of speaker. And he wanted me to come speak at a local, at an AA meeting at a local recovery house. And the primary residents at the recovery house were either new on supervision or were there because they were trying to get into recovery. And some of them had sobriety for an hour and some for a couple years. But a number of them were there because they were on probation and parole. And I told Joe, I said, I don't think this feels good. I don't think that it's the right thing for it to do, for me to be there on being an administrator with probation and parole and talking at a meeting. And Joe said, it'll be okay. Don't worry about it. And I said, oh, I'm not so certain about that. So I called a friend of mine, Dan, who's been in recovery for a number of years, and explained what Joe wanted me to do. And Dan said, I don't think you should do that. But Joe said, go ahead. Trust me. Those words that I don't always want to hear. So I go to the meeting and I state, my name is Nancy McCarthy, and I've been with probation and parole for 31 years. But before I was with probation and parole, I was the child of an alcoholic, and I am the sister of an alcoholic. And I told them of the years my brother spent trying to find sobriety, going in and out of treatment, going in and out of meetings, experiencing relapse, experiencing his situations with the law, moving from state to state until he finally found his bottom and returned to the house where we were having the very meeting. He returned to that place. But at that time, he did things a little bit different. He got to the meetings early. He found a sponsor. He found a sponsor who took him through the steps and had the patience and the wisdom that only comes for those who walked in his shoes. And then I told them what a probation and parole officer is supposed to do, what our role is in terms of helping individuals get sober and stay sober. And when I finished, one of the attendees raised their hand and said, you know, I got up today and I went to work and I wasn't going to come to this meeting, and I get here and who do I hear but you? And I thought, what the? But then I heard what you had to say. And let me tell you what my probation officer did for me. And he went on to tell about how his probation officer had helped him get sober. And it helped him find the steps that he needed to. And how he thought his probation officer was really being a jerk. But then when he started going to meetings and working the steps, he found out truly what the probation officer was trying to do. And one by one, three and four and five individuals raised their hand and said the same story. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe Joe was right. There was a number of folks in the room who were on supervision, who had just been placed on supervision, and they heard from others who had walked in their shoes that this was going to be okay, and that perhaps probation was not about punishment, but it was about help. In 2009, the Pew Center published what was considered a stunning report called the 1 in 31, which indicated that 1 in 31 individuals in the United States were involved in the criminal justice system. In 1977, this number was 1 in 77. Now, the 1 in 31, the numbers vary from neighborhood to neighborhood and state to state. But what this did is this created a wow within the correctional system, that 1 in 31 was either on probation, parole, involved in some sort of community corrections, in a local jail, local facility. And when you looked at it in terms of the cost, the dollar cost, it toppled $50 billion, which really pales in comparison to the human factors of it, the broken homes, the broken families, and the broken lives. For probation and parole, we know that 85% of our clients' behavior and their crime is linked in some form or fashion to substance abuse, whether it is in the form of alcohol or drugs. And what our job is as correctional professionals is to oversee the sanctions of the court, whether it be diversion or drug court, probation, incarceration, and then parole after they complete their term of prison. And while probation and parole standards differ from state to state, We all maintain the same basic requirements. We want individuals to be civil, sober, and contributing. And so what do we do it? How do we go about this? As correctional professionals, we are required to do a thorough assessment of the client's areas of risk and help establish plans, intervention plans, and processes to hold them accountable. As we talk about that 85% of our client base has issues related to substance abuse, it's critical for us to help motivate the client towards sobriety and to achieve it and maintain it. What we do best is we raise the bottom and we force people to make decisions. We realize that we cannot force people to change their behavior. But as you know in the words of Father Joseph Martin, you can lead a horse to water and you can't make him drink, but you can certainly hold his head long enough under the water to make him thirsty. And that is what we do. We make people thirsty. Through the authority of the court and the parole board, we can require individuals to participate in programming such as substance abuse, domestic violence. And if it is deemed that alcohol is contributing to the individual's behavior, we can direct them not to drink. Prior to 1997, parole officers routinely required people to attend 12-step meetings. But in 1977, a series of federal court rulings stated that participation in programs such as AA and NA violate an individual's First Amendment rights in terms of separation of church and state. And so what do we do? How do we work around this? We can be very creative in the work that we do. Any individual who's identified that has a drug or alcohol problem is required to attend a substance abuse program. And any program that's worth its weight in salt always has a requirement to attend 12-step meetings. While the Supreme Court mandates that we cannot refer specifically to AA, we can refer to a 12-step meeting. And that can be the meeting that happens on Thursday night in the basement of the church, or it can be the meeting that happens under the tree on Wednesdays. You take your choice. Which one's going to keep you sober? Which one's going to keep you out of jail? Most time, individuals will pick the 12-step meeting. Once a decision is made which group a client will attend, how do we support that? We are very, very good at identifying negative behavior, and we're great at telling people what to do. But we're not always good at listening, and we are not always good at connecting the dots. It is very easy to tell an individual to go to the meeting, get your slip signed, and bring it back to the probation officer. But we all know that doesn't change behavior. That does not change individuals. Putting ourselves in a client's shoes, the client may agree to attend AA, but we know that they also think, what does this mean? How is this going to affect me? We recognize that denial and anger is really a secondary emotion that covers the first, the primary, which is fear. Am I going to be accepted? Can I do this? Will I fail? Will I be accepted? And so to help with this, what we've done is we've established AA meetings in a number of our probation offices. These meetings are only open to people who are on supervision. Now, probation officers like this because they know where the client's going and they can verify that they're there and they don't have to worry about the client getting the slip signed or the dog eating it or that the slip's in four different colors in the client's handwritings. And you do see that, as you know. So while it's easy for us to do this, the client is not exposed or is only exposed to sobriety that is just like his or hers, sobriety that it's new. And they need to understand and be involved in other community groups to see the depth and the variety and the different types of individuals and how they work. To help clients also feel more at ease, we've introduced AA informational groups. And this is conducted by AA members who come in and provide an hour training every week outlining what an AA meeting is, the types of meeting, what sponsorship is, what is a sponsor, what are the steps, what are the traditions, what is spirituality, and also, of course, talking about what the big book is. Most of our staff have an understanding of substance abuse, but they do not have a keen understanding of AA. And if we expect clients to incorporate AA within their behavior, we need to be able to mirror their language and concepts and help the individual incorporate what they've learned into their daily behavior. And so to help staff learn, we've done a couple different things. All staff are required to attend an open AA meeting within their first 9 months of employment. They need to have an understanding of what an AA meeting is before they send someone to something they know nothing about. We've required a mandatory training for all staff that is presented by members of the AA community. The training provides an overview of AA that is not in the lesson plan. It is not developed by Department of Corrections staff, but rather it is a training by someone who has walked in the shoes and has talked the talk, and in the words of our staff, has made this real. The members of the fellowship review the steps, the traditions, the groups, the anonymity, and share with us how they got sobriety. This training is offered every year, and it is mandatory. And generally, the training reviews are off the chart. Everyone truly appreciates the time people take to teach them and to help them learn. Each probation officer is provided a copy of a book called Partners in Change. And I don't know if any of you have had the ability to see it or look at it, but it was written by a federal probation officer, and it's intended to be not read as a book or a novel, but as a guide, as a reference, that if a client comes in and says, I'm working my step eight, that they have something they can read and follow up on and understand what the step means and what the individual should be doing. This serves as a guide and a roadmap to AA. My expectation is not that our staff possess the in-depth understanding of each step, but rather to be able to ask the simple directed questions of what step are you on? How does this work? How does this relate to your life? How is it impacting decisions that you're making? Within the prisons, and you certainly have the experts sitting here today, within the prisons, members of the AA community become volunteers in corrections. Within probation offices, we certainly have our rules, but this certainly pales in comparison to what happens within the prisons, as you all know. But for every rule, there's a reason, and for every reason, there's security. And we are very, very tied to bureaucracy, and at times, we are very, very slow to move. Corrections asks for help, but we are not the most gracious. For the 12-step community in St. Louis, I serve as the ad hoc liaison to the prisons. If there is an issue, if volunteers cannot get improved, if staff meet with our AA members of the fellowship meet with frustration within the prison process, the chair of the corrections committee can call me, and my job is to figure out who we need to talk to, who we need to work with, and what do we need to do to get it changed. For those of you who work with corrections, I ask you, find a contact, find an ally, find someone to serve as your go-to person, and do not be afraid to call back. Believe that the unreturned call is really a lost number. We don't mean to be that way, but we are, and we get pulled in 1,000 different directions, but we have to be reminded why we are in the business that we're in. Why we got into the work of corrections, and what it is to help people become better. And when you look at the number of 1 in 31, it's a stark reminder of why we do what we do every day. We can motivate, we can encourage, but we cannot do what you do, which is to listen. And more importantly, to be able to understand in only a way that someone who has walked in their shoes can understand. For a person in prison, they have a name. But really in prison, they are only identified by a number. Their issues, their behavior results in them no longer having a name, but have a number, which is on all their belongings, it's on their mail, it is on every single thing that they own. A 12-step meeting may at first just be an escape or an opportunity for an extra cup of coffee, a reason to get out of the boredom, a place to go. But when they enter the room, they are greeted with a smile and a handshake by those who chose to do service work by carrying the message into the prison. Of all the areas of service work that can be done, my admiration for those who choose to do service work behind the walls. Members of the fellowship who go behind the walls They do not ask the number. They do not ask the crime. They do not ask, what did you do? They do not ask, why did you do it? The fellowship does not offer shame, but rather asks their name, and at the end of the meeting, asks them to come back. And that is something that they rarely hear, is, will you come back next week? Those who carry the message into the prison offer hope to those who may no longer believe that hope exists or believe that life can be better. I truly believe that when people leave prison, they make a silent promise to themselves that they're going to do better. But we all know sometimes what happens. You get back out and life happens to you. And they wake up in the morning and they're hungover and trying to figure out, just how the hell did I get where I am today? You offer this hope and the support that one needs to work through their addiction. I know you've all heard the story that a man's walking down the street and he falls in a hole and the walls are so steep that he can't get out. And a doctor passes by and the guy shouts out, hey, can you help me? And the doctor writes a prescription and throws it down the hole and then moves on. And the priest come along and the guy shouts out, Father, Father, I'm down in the hole. Can you help me out? And the father writes him a prayer and says, in our Father, and throws it down there and keeps on moving. And then a friend walks by and they say, hey, Joe, it's me. Can you help me out? And Joe jumps in the hole. And the guy says, are you nuts? We're both down here now. And the friend says, yeah, we're both down here. And I've been down here before, but I know the way out. And you know the way out. And through your service work, you bring this to others. I mentioned earlier that my brother, Mike, in his teenage years, he struggled with sobriety. And first he had issues with family and issues with the law and DWIs. And all the while he was in and out of treatment with sporadic attendance at 12-step meetings. And Mike was the one who sat closest to the door. He did not share. He did not offer. And as soon as the meeting was over, he was out the door. And as time went on, each event became a little more crazy and a little more complicated. And he'd go and he'd find a sponsor, but he did what sometimes people do. He wouldn't call the sponsor, wouldn't go to meetings with sponsor, wouldn't share with the sponsor. And then life keeps happening and keeps happening and keeps happening. And life became so unmanageable that the only way for him to get through life was to return to AA. And this time he found a sponsor, someone who gave him the guidance, someone who made him work the steps, who allowed him to understand the traditions, someone who offered Mike acceptance and an understanding that when it was time to do service work, he required Mike to do it. And Mike became a volunteer in corrections and served as a brought the message to individuals behind the walls. And he, along with hundreds of others, would drive every week an hour one way to offer a meeting in a prison. And they drove through rain and snow and terrible weather and tired and not really maybe wanting to go, but went to be able to offer the message for whom hope may only be words. Mike passed away last year, and his gift to me was his big book. And as you can see, it's had just a little bit of use over the past years. But as I prepared for today, I read through it, and I found one of Mike's notes that states, good sobriety is gradual and rests on a kind of gentleness. Each of you who work within corrections offer this gentleness, and you have my admiration, my gratitude, and my sincere appreciation for all the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next will be Warden King.
Well, I'm still thinking about Mike. That was really cool. I tell you what, she hit the nail on the head all the way around. I don't even know if I need to have a speech here. I just... I'm Burl Kane, and thank y'all. And I've been fortunate never to have had the alcohol, the problem, but I've been unfortunate to see a lot of people who have, especially in the prison. And I have to back up to my own career because I listened to you and I read the 12 steps and I prepared for this today and I realized a lot of things about prison and about rehabilitation and about people who have to change their life because it's about changing your life. It's about changing your culture if we're going to really do our job. And corrections means to correct deviant behavior. Doesn't mean to lock and feed, torture and torment. And where we really miss the boat in our business is we focus on the inmate that's in prison so much that we want to punish him because of what he did rather than try to fix him so that he doesn't do it again so there's another victim of violent crime. Because we can't help the victim that's already a victim. If they're in the grave, we can't help them. Yes, ma'am.
I'm hearing they can't hear you in the back.
You can't hear me in the back. I talk louder.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Because I'm down here on this microphone. I'll pull it out and hold it in my hand a minute. Anyway, I'm an unlikely person to be a prison warden. I'm a school teacher. I taught vocational ag education. We have any school teachers here today? Oh, cool. Let me tell you about teaching school. Okay, I went to LSU and got my degree in vo ag education. I'm the old FFA teacher. Y'all know him. And I graduated and got this job teaching school, and I was so happy I was going to teach school, and I got to the classroom, and, man, those kids run me nuts. They scream and holler. I couldn't make them be good, hardly, and they just was crazy. I said, I'm not doing this. This is nuts. So I go tell the principal, I just can't do this. I'm just not going to do it anymore. And he said, well, listen here at me, you young man. He said, you signed a contract. And you agree to do this. And if you quit, I'll say you never teach again. I said, good, I'm out of here. So I lasted 3 months. That was it. So let me tell you, any one of these school teachers can run the penitentiary. I promise you. Put your arms around them. It's hard what they do. Those kids are nuts. You bring your kids to them, you leave them with them all day long and expect them to make them be good when you didn't do it at home. And then when they fuss at them, they come running down there to school to chew you out because you was mean to their little monster. So, school teaching bad business. Now, running a prison's pretty cool. I can make you be good. You know, we had some excitement at our prison this week. 3 mornings ago, I was trying to get up and get ready to go to work, and man, the beeper comes on and the pagers and the rattling goes on. He's an inmate running from a field line and he's going across the field towards the lake. And let me tell you about Angola, 18,000 acres, 22 miles if you come in the front gate and drive all the way around to the other, around the place, 14 miles of Mississippi River. And we have a gigantic farm. We have 2,500 head of mama cows. We have all these row crops and agriculture. We never open a can. We raise everything we eat. We eat 3 meals a day for 50 cents a meal. We still plow with mules and horses. We do have some big tractors, though, to bail us out. And but those mules crank every morning. They don't burn up the clutch, and they're green, so that's good. So all that works real good for us. But anyway, this field line's going out in the field to pick the vegetables, and this guy takes off and runs from that line, and choom, right across the road he goes, right across the field. And so they bear down on him. The first guy shoots at him one time. The next time it's a warning shot. The next time the gun jams. But there was another guy with a gun, and after he shot 10 more times at him, well, he lay down in the grass and it got where they couldn't see him so we could go pick him up. So these were shooting over his head, but he wanted to stop him. We don't want to shoot him, really, you know. We just want him to stop. So anyway, we caught him, and it took about 5 minutes. One more thing. Pepper doesn't affect bloodhounds, okay? I can assure you of that. But anyway, we never lost an inmate that we didn't catch with our bloodhound. So we would have caught him anyway. And when you chase people, that's kind of different. And when you catch them, then you give them a candy bar and you try to ask them where'd they go. So how'd they get away from you? And where were you over here while they were over there? So my job, a lot of fun, really, sometimes. And now if you don't catch him, it could be a real grind, you know. Anyway, that's how our prison is. I have 6,325 prisoners, and I have about 4,500 of them have life sentences, and there's an average sentence of 95 years for the other than there's 1,000 that are short-termers, and they're going to get out, and we have them for the long-termers to teach the short-termers, because we tried an experiment to see that inmates can really be people too and really rehabilitate and really can change the culture of their peers, because they're more effective teachers than people who have not been in prison and so forth. And you just can walk right in and see where AA fits, because you're more effective peers with the ones who have a problem, because you've had it too and you can experience it and you can relate to them. Now, that's where you parallel what we did. And a lot of things I did to change the penitentiary is exactly what you do. I didn't realize it until I really got into it and studied it, the 12 steps and so forth, and realized what I do. Because my job is to not have more victims of violent crime and keep everybody safe. That's my job. I can't do that, torturing and tormenting the inmates and make it a meaner, because if you put people in cages and you treat them badly, that's how we make the dog mean that bites you. We're mean to the dog. So if you're mean to the people, you make the people meaner. And it's just that black and white way it is. So we claim to be the land of new beginnings. Our culture has changed, and what was really pretty unique, and only in Louisiana could this occur, was that I could become the senior warden of a prison having never worked in a prison before. Louisiana politics. Anyway, that was a long time ago, and I remember telling the governor, he said, I give you the job, I can give you the job, but I can't help you keep it. I said, well, I'll keep it if you give it to me. So he did, and it worked out. But let's back up a little further in my own life. I started out at a medium security prison, and my mama told me, she says, I called her to say, I'm going to be the warden of this prison. She said, well, that's pretty unlikely. You never worked in a prison. How are you going to do that? I said, well, I can do it. I know I can do it. She said, well, let me give you one piece of advice. God is going to hold you accountable that those inmates have a chance to know him. And if you don't do that, you're going to pay. I said, yes, ma'am. And so that's how it was at my house. And so I did that first prison pretty easy. It was just a little old medium security prison, 1,500 inmates. But Angola was different. I didn't want the job. And so they made me take the job temporarily. But I did an execution, and it had a profound impact on my life that I'd executed this guy, and I didn't say anything to him about his soul. It really bothered me. And I knew my mom would really, really, she had passed on by then, but she would really frown on that. So I got my business straight, and I went to the next execution. My son, 16 years old, wanted to talk to the inmate. And this is kind of where you come into play because of some of the things he said. And so I take this 16-year-old. He wants to take him some cookies. And it's a week out before we're going to do the execution. So we go through five doors to get into the cell block where he is, walk down a tier, and my son had been there before because the prison was getting really safe at that time, and kids could go, or mine could, and go with me. So we went down a tier, and Antonio James came up to the bars, and we shook hands, and I said, Antonio, Marshall wants to ask you a question. And he brought you some cookies. So he liked the cookies, so they shook hands, and he said, Antonio, why are you here? I'm 16. I want to know why you're here. You're a Christian now, and you changed your life. Why are you here? Why does my daddy have to execute you? And so he said, Marshall, it's a jungle out there for kids. And the jungle is that you have to make decisions. And you make the wrong decision, there's things in the jungle can really hurt you really bad. And you have friends and peers. And your peers lead you the wrong way. And so you have to make a choice. And in the jungle, all these trails are there. And when they say, let's go over here and do this, you're supposed to look at the crossroad and you're supposed to see your dad's face or your mom's face. They won't ever tell you wrong. They'll lead you right. And you won't make a mistake, because my mom is going to be here when your dad executes me, but my friends won't be here. They don't come to see me. Only my mom. They all gone. I don't even know where they are. They gave me up. But I was guilty. I shot the man. And so we were robbing people in New Orleans, and we'd stick the gun in their face, and they'd give us some money, and we'd go buy drugs and what have you. I didn't have a daddy. I would sometimes sleep under the house. And so he didn't have a daddy. Okay, so anyway, later on we talked about the thief on the cross, and this day I'll see you in paradise. We talked about that assured him that when he dies he would go to heaven, and we talked some more, and he talked to Marshall some more, and he asked me would I hold his hand. Well, what I'm sure I'll hold your hand while this is going on, because he wanted to be connected to this earth as he reached to the next. So that's a very noble thing to do. But here's where you come to play. This is what is so important. Where was his dad? Was he impaired and he couldn't be there? Where was he to raise him? And that's, I get chilled on my arm. This is what you do. You take people who are dysfunctional and you lift them up and you help them. And you don't know how many people are not victims of violent crime because of what you did. You don't realize it. You don't have a clue. And when you come to the penitentiary and you don't ever miss because you are so reliable, it's incredible. You're better than the preacher, because all the preacher wants to do is get in the pulpit and preach down to them and tell them they're going to hell. You want to sit there with them and let them talk and help them solve their problem, because they talk it out. You're more effective than he is. And I know, because I have six AA operations in my prison because it's divided up so large. But you come. You're reliable. You're the face at the crossroad. Or you call someone to be the face at the crossroad that otherwise would have a child sleeping under the house. So what you do is the most noble thing anyone could do. There's no group of people who do more to help society than it is you. And you're silent. There's 55,000 of you here. I didn't know it. You don't seek glory. You don't care. You care about people. It's amazing what you do. It's amazing. And so what we did is, in the prison, we're doing exactly what you do yourself. You are changing people's culture. You are changing the way people live who would fall flat on their face and be a disaster. We would have more people in prison if you didn't do what you do. And so in our prison, we see our change coming, because now it's changed its culture from within. The prison did exactly what you did. You changed cultures from within. You changed from inside out. I realized at the prison that I couldn't change them. Preachers can't preach to them. We can't talk to them down. They have to change the culture in the prison themselves. And they did. They did. Because we gave them the opportunity to do it, and we opened up the walls and the fences, and the AA folks came, and they were reliable, and we realized it. And they depend on you like children. They're just like children again. That's why I can successfully run a prison as a school teacher, because I'm treating them like teenagers. That's exactly what they become, because they have nothing. So a little is a lot. And a little is just those very few small things they have to deal with in their lives. And so they cling to somebody that will come and be reliable and say, I'm going to come back next week. And they say, yeah, sure, you do. You do. You're dependable. That's the most important thing you do, is to be dependable and be there for them. And you change lives. Now, your culture changed. You know how you change your culture. You went back to God. You did your 12-step program. And I don't even have it. Lost it when I walked up here. Anyway, you went back to God. And so that's what we did in the prison. And so their culture changed. So today in the prison, we don't have school teachers anymore. We have inmates who teach other inmates. Inmates teach others anger management. Cage your rage. Can you imagine one inmate teaching another how to control your anger? Now, here's how this happened. We got a seminary. So we have our own preachers, and we created them, a four-year seminary. But the point is, let's go back to what the point is. The point is, we were changing culture from within and not from without, because you can't do it from without. You can beat on them, preach to them all you want. They got to do it themselves. And that's what this whole AA thing is about. It's about self. It's about me. It's about how I do my life. And I can't do it without the support of somebody else. I can't do it without the 12-step program. In our AA clubs, we call them clubs because they have concessions at the rodeo and they generate revenue and so forth. And by generating revenue, then they can do things for other people because it's about giving to others. Because they can't go to a meeting outside the walls. They can have meetings inside, but they can't do what you do there. But they can help support others. And it's our AA club that builds the wheelchairs that we send to third world countries, and as many as 1,500 of them we've sent out to other countries because they want to give back. Now let's talk about this criminal. This criminal is a taker. He takes your lawnmower, your weed eater, he takes your boat, your tractor, and he takes your body, and he takes your purse. He'll take your money. Okay, so what is that? He's immoral. He is absolutely immoral person. How do you cure that? It's real simple. You cure that by making him become a moral person. What are you doing in AA? You're teaching them to become accountable to themselves and thinking of others and to become moral people. That's what you're teaching them. So if we're going to change the culture in a prison, we got to do what you do. Otherwise, we're going to recidivate at the rate of 50%. One out of two that gets out comes back. No, we've seen that change now. We have 4,000 less inmates in our system than we had 3 years ago because the culture is changing. In closing, the most important thing to remember is you're the one that causes the face to be there at the crossing, at the turn in the road. Because if there's no mom or no dad because they're impaired and they're throwing their lives away in front of their children and not raising their children are more apt to become murderers, robbers, killers, what have you, and come to prison. And they're more apt to be victims. So as I leave you, I want you to think about that, because there's people, and you won't know it till you get to the pearly gate, but there's going to be somebody that wasn't a victim of violent crime because of what you did. And that's why this is so noble, Alcoholic Anonymous, AA. It's my favorite and best and most effective program I have in the prison, and I have many. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you so much. Our last speaker is Sharon Hickey, who was the Director of Community and Correction Services in the Yukon. Sharon?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Sharon Hickey. I won't ask for a show of hands. I'll just help you out. The Yukon is next door to Alaska. And I'm originally from Eastern Canada, and when I retired last year, moved back sort of home. I'm in Nova Scotia now, which is still attached to Canada. I'm from the island of Newfoundland and Labrador. Okay. I'm not sure I've got anything to say. These guys pretty well did it. My story starts with the post office. When I was a kid, my dad worked for the post office, and so he had a good federal government job in a rural community where poverty was rampant. And so when I grew up, I thought, well, I want a good federal job too. So to go to work for the post office, you had to study and pass an exam, which I did. But when I got the second letter in the mail, I thought it was an invitation to another exam. So I tore it up. And I never did go to work for the post office. That was my letter of offer. So I went into healthcare instead. I could get a free education as a nurse, and I thought, well, I'm the oldest of seven kids. Sign me up. And my first job out of nursing was as a in pediatric psychiatry. I had always been interested in psychiatry. And as a student, had worked at the pediatric hospital. And so I went there and then eventually got a bit restless and thought, well, I need to make more money, and I could do that by getting a good federal job. And they had jobs in the federal prison system, which is where I went to work. And I discovered my background in pediatric psychiatry really came in handy. They were the same, just taller. So in Canada, I've worked for the federal correctional system and then the territorial correctional system. And I'm going to open with a few generalities about corrections. My experience is largely with adult males. I have had, at times, responsibility for victim services. And in Canada, generally, there are special programs and services for women and young offenders. So my experience is largely about adult males. And I didn't know until I prepared to come here that AA has been involved in corrections for 73 of your 80 years. So... And, of course, I never got to meet Bill W., who is easily the master of understatement. On page 17 of the big book, he says, "We are people who ordinarily would not mix." No kidding. As a correctional administrator, I can say that AA has a sound structure and processes for taking the fellowship of AA into corrections. Was talking about the procedures that they have and how they're much greater in institutions. That's largely to keep everybody safe. And as I researched the work that AA has done to go into institutions and be able to safely go in there, it's excellent. And the reference materials that have been prepared are also good. And it's safety is for everyone. Correctional systems exist on several levels. Usually there's institutional and community corrections. And there are different levels of authority. In the states, you might have county, state, and federal institutions. We have them at the provincial and territorial and federal level in Canada. And institutions have different levels of security. Usually, they can go from minimum, medium, maximum, and sometimes you'll hear about super maximum. Sociologists talk about the culture of a community. And one of the things that an important liaison with an institution helps you with is what they call the CON code. That's the culture of the inmate community. It has different features to it. Some is that you never talk to staff. You do your own time. You mind your own business. You certainly can't trust anyone. And two of the more unusual ones that I ever found, and I still don't understand, is you're not to whistle. I have no idea why. And I don't know if it's the same in Canada, but in the States, but in Canada, the worst thing you can call someone is a goof. That can actually get you killed. And I don't know if it's the same down here, but I have never understood those two things. But they're very real, and there's quirks like that about the culture that you need to know. Many of you will already know most offenders commit their crimes while they're impaired. Drugs, alcohol, or both. And different studies will tell you different amounts, like you can get official statistics that say 80%. In my experience, and especially as I worked up north, it was more like 95%. So alcohol and drugs are a big problem for offenders. Many will reoffend if they don't change or get help. I say, in fact, in my experience, most will. We're looking to the system to be helpful and to help people change and manage their lives in a way that the family hasn't been able to do it, school hasn't done it, the community hasn't done it. So it's a tall order, and certainly we can't do it alone. And getting help is hard. Offering help is hard. There are never enough resources. And so, again, the help that you are able to offer is invaluable because it helps us address a major problem in a major way, in ways that we just couldn't do. In addition to offenders having addictions, especially over the last number of years as mental health facilities downsize, they also usually have other problems. Many have a mental illness, and others also have personality disorders. That makes these folks have very complex problems that are hard to deal with. The other reality for us is, in Canada, most will be released. So these people are our neighbors. And while I was a federal employee for a long number of years, and we said that was true, when I moved up north, they were the people that I was having coffee with because they walked into the coffee shop. They were the people who were at the softball game. They really were my neighbor. So we have a vested interest to be able to help folk. Statistically, general supported or gradual supported release helps offenders make it, as opposed to an abrupt release at the end of their sentence with no resources. And there are offenders who will not participate in gradual release processes. They want to do their own time. They don't want the state having any control of them. those folks are at higher risk to reoffend. And you might not think it, but drugs and alcohol are readily available in most institutions. And it devils the life out of us. There's drug dogs, there's random urinalysis, there's, you know, well, when I was working in a psychiatric prison hospital, the brewmasters would always hide the brew in the cells of the mentally ill, because even if you catch them, and usually you do because they couldn't wait for it to ferment, they drank it and got sick, you can't take any action against them. They're not criminally responsible. So in thinking about AA, I decided to come at it from a bit of a pragmatic point of view. And I'm the sort of person, fortunately or unfortunately, it's a wonder I believe in germs because I can't see them. So I started thinking about AA from a perspective of, okay, why bother? What's it to you? From a point of the institution, the offender, the AA-er, and the community. So for an institution, public safety is job one. If there's millions of offenders in the correctional systems, there are millions more affected by their actions. Think of their families, their victims' families, their children. So there's a real ripple effect when you work with offenders. AA has a proven track record as a sound process for getting started and getting going and staying safe in institutions. It's my favorite program, too. There are never enough resources to provide people with the help they need, and AA helps more than you'd ever know. I doubt that there's been studies done that prove what the financial impact is of what your contribution is, because AA doesn't study itself like that, but it's immeasurable. You're there. You're often there when nobody else is. So thank you for that. And for an institutional manager, seeing if somebody's participating in AA is also a way to tell, are they serious about their programming? Are they interested in addressing what we call their criminogenic needs? But basically, are they interested in getting sober and staying sober? Because they don't have to be. In the institution and the pressures that are within it make it possible for them to keep doing the same old. So there's advantages to a bureaucracy or an institution for having AA programs in them. For an offender, what's in it for them? Well, not drinking is something within their control, and it's easier to address than a mental illness or a personality disorder. They can not drink far easier than they can become less narcissistic or deal with the schizophrenia or the depression or the anxiety. They can do this. When they go to meetings, they're associating with people who have what we call pro-social values. I don't know about your mother, but mine always told me I was known by the company I kept. And certainly in prison, they have no choice but live with criminals. But if they want to get a different perspective than the one they already know, it's really important to associate with volunteers. So the offender gets to associate with people who are not like them. It also gives offenders experience with making positive choices in an environment that does not make that easy to do. Most decisions are made for offenders because that's the way you have to run an institution. They don't get to pick their health care provider. They don't get to decide what's for dinner. They often don't even get to decide how they're going to recreate or if they're going to. Those decisions are made for them. So having experience with coming to meetings is helping them make choices. The other thing, and I think this is a real gift of AA, is it serves as an anchor no matter where they go. If it's another institution, if it's the community, if it's another country, there's AA. It's an anchor. It's something that can be familiar. In my time, I worked with people who had done so much time. They were lifers. They'd never seen a bank machine. They didn't know how to work. They'd never seen a microwave. Certainly, they didn't know about cell phones. They'd been in that long that technology had passed them by. So when you're released to an environment where it's so bewildering, it's such a comfort to have the anchor of knowing that AA is there. The other big thing that AA does or offers for offenders is it offers hope. And hopefulness feels better than hopelessness. Many of you would know that. My brother was dying a few years ago of lung cancer. He was only 52. And he was a nurse as well. And in fact, he was so positive and upbeat and optimistic and making these ridiculous long-term plans, the staff in the hospital came to me to say, "Does he know he's dying?" And I said, "Well, he is completely compliant with your treatment plan. But yes, it's because feeling hopeful feels better." And it does. Then there's things that are not flattering, but it's true for offenders, that sometimes coming to a meeting means you're going to get coffee or goodies or helps pass the time. Might even help with getting parole or getting you on the right foot with your parole officer. And it also can help with reducing the stress. Doing time is hard. It is among the most difficult environments you can imagine, especially with gang issues. Being around people who will often hurt you if they get the chance just can drive you out of your mind with stress. And there's only so many segregation beds to go around. You can't lock everybody up because something might happen to them. So learning to do time is tough. So what's in it for the AA-er? Well, they can't come to you, so you have to go to them. The other big thing that you can't overstate is you get them. Their motivation may be suspect, insincere, wavering, whatever. You get it. You role model selflessness and that it is possible to break free. I was reading in one of the AA and Corrections books about people coming to prison to find freedom. I know in prison I largely found goodness. And it was in there. It had to be cultivated. And I didn't know that I was looking for it or looking for it there. But that's what I found. And you especially find that when AA fellowship exists in an institution. It also helps you with your sobriety, working the 12 steps and the traditions. This is a win, win, win all around. Most offenders have experienced a lifetime of rejection. Bringing the message of AA fellowship inside shows them there are people who've been there and who have not given up on them, who are down in the hole and know the way out. You also demonstrate by living it that trusting doesn't always have to hurt. There aren't always negative consequences to taking a chance. The other thing for you is that if you go into an institution or you help with community corrections, you're going to meet some really interesting people. I can't say this everywhere, but murderers were always my favorite types. Because other than having lost it on one occasion usually, they were pro-social people. They had jobs, they coached Little League, they were regular folk who made a very bad choice. You'll also get to understand the correctional system a little better. I mean, there's enough opportunities in everyone's life to volunteer and to participate in community that corrections doesn't rank up there for a lot of people. But institutions and the staff who are in them, community corrections as well, they really care about our communities. And if you participate in a correctional AA program, you'll get to understand a little bit more about how it's supposed to work, how it can work, and the extraordinary efforts people will go to help people turn their lives around. Another thing, and I got this in my Costco magazine that came this week, volunteering is good for you. There's actually a study that says you might live longer, have a 20% drop in mortality, experience less depression, and have higher levels of life satisfaction. Go to jail. And another study, a Carnegie Mellon University study, adults over 50 who volunteer are 40% less likely to have high blood pressure. I'm down with that. Yeah. Offenders can count on you. You'll be there for them when they're ready. And readiness is a whole other topic. But you know yourself, it doesn't often click the first meeting. You also help offenders challenge any self-perception of themselves as victims. Offenders, like the warden said, will take what they want. They're very self-absorbed. And I suppose on some level, well, if we're not all managing our own lives, who's managing it? But it's useful to have somebody else to talk to bounce ideas off of, and to see themselves as other than somebody who got done wrong. In AA, everyone's equal. In correctional facilities, this is not the case. The change in the power of differential is something that many offenders need time to adjust to. It can feel like your head being on backwards, being in a room full of equals. The other thing is that we're all more alike than not alike. And by taking the meetings inside, you get to live that, show people. And there's no us and them to the same degree that there is when people don't know people like you. You're there because you want to be there. You're not paid to be there. You're not sentenced to be there. You're there of your own free will. And that has a whole element of caring to it. And that sending a message about people mattering that isn't conveyed by folks who, as caring as they may be, if they're staff, there's always going to be that aura of, well, you have to be here. And sometimes your believing in offenders helps them believe in themselves. I've often said that when you go into a system, you can do everything except a heart transplant. But it's a little bit like the Grinch, whose heart was, I think, three sizes too small. You can help them grow that heart. AA is invaluable in correctional institutions. And Bill W. said that every AAer has been, in a sense, a prisoner. Investing in offenders is investing in our community, our nation, and our world. This is hard work. It's also heart work. It really is. Jean Vanier is a famous Canadian, and he's famous for having been the co-founder of La Arche, which is a system, a network for homes for folks with intellectual disabilities. And he said, "We do not have to be saviors of the world. We are simply human beings enfolded in weakness and hope, called together to change our world one heart at a time." Thank you.
Help me to thank the speakers again.